Rachel Grimm, and welcome to the podcast With All Your Mind. I'm here to help us understand the Bible with cultural and historical context, linguistic info, and other cool stuff. Enjoy. Hey guys, welcome back. This is Rachel, and this is With All Your Mind, and this is our last regular episode for season three. It is definitely a summary, a culmination. I'm trying to think of a different word other than culmination, but I guess that works. A culmination of the whole rest of the season. So don't just jump in on this one episode. It'll make sense, so much more sense, and you'll appreciate it so much more if you listen to the rest of the season first. So don't just jump in on this one, even if you'd like the title. Listen to the rest of the season first, okay? So yeah, I start my first Biblical Hebrew master's class next week. I took classes at the university level like 10 years ago, but this is a part of a program, and I'm actually going to do the whole program this time. So I'm getting excited about that since it's finally becoming real. I've been basically planning for this for a whole year already. So it's finally happening. I don't know how it's going to work. We'll see how it works. Yeah, there's a lot going into it. A lot of babysitting, a lot of TV for my boys probably. So anyway, so some FYIs, Google Podcasts, if you use that, is going away in March. They're just getting rid of it entirely. So if you use Google Podcasts for anything, I'm sure you've received messages about this, but just in case, it's going away completely in March. And some different options are YouTube Music. I think that's what they're switching their stuff over to. But then, you know, there's a whole bunch of other stuff that you can look into. And Pandora might also become more limited, or your content might change if you listen through Pandora. So just watch out for those two in March of 2024. They will definitely be changing. All right. So since this episode is, like I said, like a culmination of the whole rest of the season, I have to recap what we've talked about for the rest of the season. And it is generally language and culture in the Bible. And language and culture are always present in everything. They are the medium, the method, the conduit, the tunnel, the hose through which content comes, right? They're not the content. They can be the content, but they are how we get information. And medium, how we get stuff, matters, and it affects the content. So some examples of that you can see in other places. There are scientific studies that if you read content on a screen, you will have less retention. And I know this inherently. I know that I just don't remember things as well when I read it on a screen. I hate reading on a screen. So I love reading paper books. And so I'm expensive to upkeep with books. But that is a medium effect, right? The medium through which you read affects what you read and how you read. In a similar way, learning online versus in person, it's just not as good most of the time. The pandemic showed us that with test scores for high schoolers like dropping, and kids in elementary schools going into like fourth grade without really knowing how to read because they were in kindergarten and first grade during the pandemic. So medium, how we do things, in what language, through what format, through what culture, matters. It affects things. You can know this in a very real, practical way by drinking beverages out of different containers. If you put something into a wine glass, you feel fancy. If you put it into a Dixie cup, there's a whole different connotation with Dixie cups, right? If you put it into a kid's cup, you know, there's just all sorts of different feelings and effects that you can have. You drink something out of a metal cup. Some people love it. Some people hate it because of the effect it has, both on the beverage and just on your how it feels to you. Medium matters. So with language and culture, language of the Bible, culture of the Bible, that's the medium through which we get the Bible. It matters. So here are the topics that we've talked about in season three. We talked about Biblical Hebrew style with parallelism, chiasms, and acrostics. Those are probably somewhat familiar to you. And then the not-so-familiar verbs of motion. They're just a category of grammar, of linguistics, that are just their own special little beast. And in biblical Hebrew, they might actually make things sound a little more formal than what that culture actually is. So the linguistics make the culture look different. Similarly, biblical Hebrew does not have a word for yes. So there's a whole different system for how to say yes. And so we have to think instead about whether somebody says yes or no. We can think about whether they agree or disagree. And then we can think about, oh, okay, that's much more flexible of a way to agree. And we don't have to be so strict with which particular words are used in order to agree with somebody, right? So in biblical Hebrew, it's much more common to echo. Do you want me to go? Go, right? So that's an echo system. Biblical Hebrew uses an echo system. Then we went on to biblical Hebrew having different idioms and expressions, including how to express emotion and how to mark quotations in the Bible. And then we talked about the evidence of Roman and Greek culture in the lives of New Testament characters with things like the triclinium, talking about logos, and potentially referencing Aesop's fables. So Jesus actually using culturally relevant literature of his time. And then the use of the Septuagint by Jesus and others in the New Testament. Paul using a standard Greco-Roman letter format, but adapting it to Christian themes and needs. And then finally, what architecture told us about the people that Christians hung out with and the type of people that Christians were. These are all features, characteristics of the texts, or what is sometimes called artifacts in them, that show us the culture and ways of doing things of the people living at the time. And what is interesting is that there are so many cultures in play in what we call Israel or Palestine, or the Promised Land, or whatever you want to call it, all through its history. Before Abraham and his many sons came, it was a land of many different people groups, the Canaanites and the Amorites and on and on. Then there were enemies and friends alike, like the Philistines and the Egyptians. Not to mention that Abraham himself was a Mesopotamian. He was from Ur in modern-day Iraq, most likely. And Jesus had his lineage from Moabites, from whoever lived in Jericho through Rahab. And then if you remember, Bathsheba's husband was Uriah the Hittite. It's very possible that Bathsheba was a Hittite too. I mean, she could have been Jewish, but she could have been Hittite. The Israelites lived in the land of Babylon and Assyria, and they were ruled by those same people, plus then the Greeks and then the Romans. And their land was fought over by all of those groups, and their rights and land were often taken away and sometimes given back. The Bible often talks of remaining separate from the nations, that Jews were to keep their identity and their religious beliefs distinct and intact, distinct from the nations around them, because they were to be a nation of priests, a missionary nation that would teach all the other nations about God, the God of the Bible, about Yahweh. So what that does is it's easy to have us go into the New Testament with mixed feelings. The Jews were protective of their nation and their temple. And we can easily see this with the religious leaders because they're upset that Jesus was causing problems for them. Right? In John 11, we have this verse, and it's the religious leaders talking. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him. And then the Romans will come and take away both our temple and our nation. They had a legitimate fear that, oh man, this has happened before, where if we have problems, if there looks like there's rebellion, they just come in and smash us, right? And they might not let us do sacrifices at the temple again. That was a legitimate fear. And guess what? It happened. The Romans came in and destroyed the temple. The religious leaders weren't crazy. They were scared. And the religious leaders tried to have the people turn against Jesus by having him in any way support the Roman authorities. The Jews also often demanded that new Christians first convert to Judaism before they became Christians. It's kind of a long road there. But in the Old Testament, that made sense, right? Before Jesus came around, that was your only choice, convert to Judaism. And at the same time, were happy when we learned that the Christian leadership in Jerusalem said that new Christians did not need to be circumcised and follow the dietary law. As it says in Acts 21, they just need to stay away from food sacrificed to idols and sexual immorality. And there's a few other details in there. We can handle that, right? So there's a lot of conflict regarding culture and politics in the Bible. And you can see the controversy of it all through the New Testament in the life of Jesus and in Acts and in the writings of Paul. He's constantly addressing how do we manage not being Jews, but being with Jews if we're not Jews, right? The Jews and the Greeks. And Paul talks about things like there's no longer Jew nor Greek, male nor female. But then he talks about don't eat food sacrificed to idols. So they're constantly working through these little nitty-gritty details that seem to us like nitty-gritty details. It was a big deal to them. So when I was reading John as a part of my quiet time, I was struck with how perfectly Jesus avoided controversy while not backing down from any of it. He was honest, strong, yet gentle when gentleness was needed, and he always avoided traps and manipulation with just awesome skill. And then, so after that, I was like, okay, he did that. But how did he interact with culture? How did he do this? Because you can't avoid culture. You can't avoid language. It is the medium for all of these things. You have to use words. You have to live. You have to choose how to sleep. And you have to choose how to eat. And you have to choose how to go to the bathroom, how to bathe, how to wash your hands. And a lot of these things mattered for Jewish culture. So this was my question for the end of season 3. And I was always thinking about it in the back of my head when I was going through all of the other episodes and all of the other topics. How and where can we see Jesus' interactions with culture? And what do they say about Jesus? And that's what we're answering in this episode. Jesus draws from and is a part of many cultures, but in some ways, he redefines what it means to obey God in a way that makes it an entirely new thing. So let's look at some particulars with that. First of all, there's some things that we don't know specifically, or we don't know a lot about at all. There's a little bit of debate, and it really depends on who you talk to. I feel like I'm already jumping into a controversy by even introducing this topic, but we don't know what language Jesus spoke in his everyday life. Some people will be like, super hardcore, it was Hebrew. And other people will be like, duh, you idiot, it was Aramaic. So it was Hebrew or Aramaic, I don't really care. But he definitely knew Greek, he definitely knew Aramaic, and he definitely knew Hebrew. So he was trilingual. We just don't know which one he babbled in as a baby, right? And what were his first words in? They were probably Aramaic, but I leave room for the unknown because we don't know. So we do know, what do we know? That Jesus lived the synagogue life. He went to the synagogue regularly and he was respected there. He lived the temple life. He went to the temple at festivals. People expected him there. And he just had a normal Jewish life. And he might have had some Hebrew ways of talking, you know, Semitisms, just things that come as a way of your culture leaking out, whether it's a part of the broader culture or not. Like how my husband's family brings up Pennsylvania Dutch every once in a while. And I still make fun of Ryan for some ways that his grammar isn't right, but it's a Dutchy way. Like I know it's just a part of the way he talks from the way he grew up. There's not too many of those anymore. I've beaten them out of them. But do you remember all the times in the New Testament that someone asked Jesus, are you the Son of God? Or are you the Messiah? Or are you the King of the Jews? And Jesus never once just said the word yes. And so a lot of people have used that to say he didn't agree that he was any of those things. And I'll say that again. Because Jesus never used the word yes, people will argue that he didn't agree. But we now know some facts that will help you figure out at least one of the reasons why that isn't a good argument. Saying the word yes is just one of the world's linguistic systems for how to agree with someone. And Hebrew, one of the languages that Jesus knew, didn't do that. And I did look into Greek and Aramaic to see if they had ecosystems or what type of agreement system they had. And it's just a little bit fuzzier, so I'm not going to get into all those details. But we know that Hebrew had an ecosystem, which means they did not just straight up say yes. And we do tend to use the linguistic patterns and habits of our native language or of the languages that we are very, very familiar with. So did Jesus never say yes to those questions because he wasn't used to it, or it wasn't normal to say that in Greek or whatever language he was using? Potentially. We don't know, but it certainly does leave room for looking at other things, right? Let's look at one of those passages. This is from Matthew 27, where Pilate is questioning Jesus a lot, and he doesn't answer anything except to one question. In Matthew 27:11, it says, "Jesus stood before the governor, and the governor asked him, 'Are you the king of the Jews?' 'You have said so,' Jesus replied." He doesn't say yes. But he does say something that is kind of like the ecosystem. He does the same thing when the chief priest asks him if he's the Christ in the previous chapter. The high priest asks him, "I charge you under the oath by the living God, tell us if you are the Messiah, the Son of God." And Jesus answers, "You have said so." It's really not much of an answer. It's not entirely clear. But I think the chief priest would have taken it as a yes. But Jesus doesn't stop there. He gives a few references to the Old Testament pictures of the Messiah, but weird ones. He continues and says, "But I say to all of you, from now on, you will see the Son of Man," which he's referred to himself many times as the Son of Man, "sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven." It's all a little confusing, but we at least need to keep in mind that agreement isn't always just about saying yes. Sometimes it's about echoing the question. So, whenever anybody brings that up as a way of saying that Jesus is not the Messiah he never claimed to be, you can say, well, actually in Hebrew, there was an ecosystem of agreement, so Jesus didn't necessarily need to say yes. Okay? Keep that in your back pocket. Now, on to some other things. If you remember, we talked about how Jesus might have referenced some of Aesop's fables, Greek stories, and quoted from the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Old Testament. Why? Well, a couple of different reasons. It might have just been normal. It might have been more understandable for a lot of people that weren't Bible nerds. If the spoken language at the time was Aramaic and the Old Testament was in Hebrew, it might have been like reading King James Bible. Like, you can understand it, but it's just a lot of work and it feels culturally outdated. And if you had a choice between King James Bible or NIV or the New Living Translation or the Message, that's kind of what the Hebrew Old Testament and the Septuagint were like at the time of Jesus. They might have used the Septuagint just because it was so much easier for people to understand. And it might have even been more understandable to the Bible nerds if Greek was their native language anyway. But what does this say about Jesus? It says he adapted. He didn't demand his own culture and his own language to be dominant and necessary. I don't imagine he would have gotten upset if the waitress at his restaurant didn't have perfect Hebrew. I don't think he would have been disgruntled if the local baker in Nazareth only spoke Greek. And it also means that Jesus didn't believe he absolutely had to read the Bible in Hebrew in order to understand it and feel connected to God. He was flexible with his Bible translations. So last of all, we're going to move on to a different scene, the Last Supper. This is a scene that I've been thinking about for literally years because it just seemed odd to me. It seemed like a really un-Jewish scene, a really just weird, because Jews really didn't recline or lie down to eat like the Greek upper class did. They sat like normal human beings, like we tend to do. So why, at this really iconic and important meal, did Jesus and his disciples eat in a style that wasn't very traditional? And when I thought about it, it kind of bothered me. I like to think of Jesus as a man of the people. He was constantly with the poor and the downtrodden and the sick and defending and caring for them. And he worked to expose the deceit and manipulation of the ruling class, the Pharisees and the Sadducees. Jesus was always opposing the Pharisaic ways of oppressing the people for power, for control, to maintain the religious status quo in opposition to what God was actually doing. But Jesus was never really opposed to upper class. He was never really opposed to the rich. He did talk about how it's harder to enter the kingdom of God when you're rich, but he wasn't opposed to rich people. He healed Jairus' daughter. He was kind to the rich young ruler, and he approved of Zacchaeus when he said he would restore to the people what he had taken. He didn't demand that of him, and he didn't demand more than what Zacchaeus offered. So the triclinium is kind of like a symbol to me. So how did the triclinium work into all of this? Well, I saw it as Jesus identifying with the upper class and the rich, and I did not like that. It made it seem like they were welcome and okay too. And I realized that maybe that was the point. That maybe Jesus chose to have the Last Supper in a nice place as a way to care for his disciples. To take them on a little spiritual retreat before they had the most traumatic experience of their lives. But did he also do it to identify with different cultures? To say that even Greek culture was welcome? That not only the Jews could be a part of the kingdom of God, but also the Gentiles. And many at that time would call all Gentiles just Greeks. It's like kind of like Jew and not Jew, Jew and Greek. Jesus made clear in many situations that Gentiles would be a part of the kingdom of God as well. Like the Syrophoenician woman who was willing to just accept the crumbs of the kingdom of God. Or the whole feeding of the 4,000. That was to a Gentile crowd. Or the guy that had legion, that he was demon-possessed and clawing away at the tombs and people were scared of him. That was in Gentile territory. And he doesn't reject rich people. The women that helped him in his ministry, like Joanna and Mary and Martha, and women that Paul met, like Lydia, she was a businesswoman. All those women were likely rich, or at least comfortable. Jesus accepted their help and support and welcomed them into his inner circle. Mary and Martha were in. I was surprised by Jesus' acceptance, which means Jesus does not reject people simply because other people want him to. We know that. But he doesn't even include those groups of people that it's socially acceptable to reject, like the rich people, the upper class, the foreigners, and the foreign. He allowed for people of all cultures and all social status. And I wasn't entirely sure how to say this, but I can't say that anywhere in the Bible I see anything like pride in one's own culture or social status as a good thing. Protecting and guarding what is commanded by God, yes, but not pride. So that's what I get out of all of this culture and language talk for Jesus. He was a part of it in many ways. He used language. He was a part of several cultures, but he never, never used it, any of it, as a weapon or as a way to exclude. He was always including even the people that we would be totally okay as Christians rejecting. I'm going to leave it at that, guys. I don't know when I'll be back again with more episodes. I hope it's sooner rather than later. And once in a while, I'll pop in and let you guys know what's going on with me and if we plan future episodes. But thank you so much for listening, and I hope you guys all have a great day. Bye.